There's so many magnificent British comedians, and I've been playing over there for years, and I just absolutely adore the friends that I have over there. And the place for me that I think is one of the greatest comedy clubs in the world is the Comedy Store. And it just to stand on stage there killing is one of the greatest feelings in the world, like better than drugs, better than sex. And, you know, the place is raucous. And then you're also in front of just, you know, not only British Londoners, but, you know, people from all over the world. You're performing to Muslims and Sikhs and just humanity. And it's just absolutely the greatest feeling in the world to stand there and kill. I made friends with Shaja Mirza years ago, and, you know, she's a Muslim female comedian, and that's my favorite thing about comedy is that, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if you're poor or white or Hindu or black or Latin or, you know, gay, whatever. All that it comes down to is if you're funny, and it's a really exclusive, you know, fraternity of people that can actually be comedians. All right. I'm with my... Are you here?
Oh, yeah.
All right. All right. I'm with my good buddy, Shazia Mirza, a fantastically funny comedian. And let's go to... where did we meet? Because you just said it to me, and I didn't realize that you had come to the taping of my show because of our mutual good friend.
Yeah, I came to the taping of your show in Holland. Yeah, in Amsterdam, when you were doing your own chat show. I had only met you once briefly before, and I turned up to your chat show, and it was bizarre. It was bizarre. You know, you had Ron Jeremy, the porn star, on there. I was like, God, what kind of show is this?
I can't believe you were at that taping, too, because it was like, it wasn't my idea. It was the TV people. There were girls wrestling in mud and bikinis. I mean, you must have thought that was really bizarre.
And then at the end of the show, I get to meet your mom. It was really bizarre.
Because that's not the way that I remembered it. The way I remembered it was that, I mean, that's awesome that you were there at that taping. The way I remembered it was that you and I had worked with each other in Den Haag. And I thought you were wonderfully funny, great one-liners, and your, you know, your deadpan delivery was so on the money and so great. I've never seen a Muslim woman in a head veil do stand-up. So it was really, like, groundbreaking, I thought. And I remember that you hated Holland when you first went there. You really thought it was, you thought it was Sodom and Gomorrah. It was just such a den of iniquity, and there was so much evil everywhere. You said something about just, you could, just the presence of...
It was the land of the infidel. It was the land of the infidel. Everybody was sinning the whole time. And I'd never seen, you know, I'd never seen legal drugs. I'd never seen people drinking so much. I'd never seen prostitutes, and it was all legal, and it was like so liberating and so free. I mean,
it must have been really overwhelming, right?
It was. It took me a while to get into it. It took me a while to really get into it and realize that this is what they do in the West. You know, when I think about my friends who are male and female comedians, you know, they get pissed, they have taken drugs, and, you know, they've had sex with lots of different people, and they've had relationships, and, you know, my life didn't begin till I was 20. You know, before that, I was never allowed out of the house. I'd never met any men apart from my brothers and my father. I'd never spoken to any men outside of the house, you know. I never had any male friends till I was 25. And even then, they were gay male friends. And, you know, I had a really sheltered life and a really sheltered upbringing. And I thought I would be married with kids, living in some house in Birmingham by the time I was 25. I didn't think I would be a stand-up comedian traveling around the world, you know, trying to make people laugh, hanging out with black and white American comedians in Amsterdam while they're taking me to see hookers at midnight. I mean, Tom, why did you do that? You dragged me out of my bed to see those hookers. Come on, Shazia, look at this.
Not true at all.
But, you know, it's not the life I thought I would live.
In the West, we don't. In America, we don't have prostitutes or, you know.
You do, Tom. You can't buy. You do, but it's not legal. It's not like they don't stand in windows selling, you know, themselves. And the thing is, I was really fascinated. I used to walk down in the red light area by myself every other night because it became addictive. And I was just fascinated by the women that stood in these windows because, you know, they weren't trash. These were like beautiful, oh my God, beautiful Thai women. And they were just gorgeous. And I used to look at them and think, wow, what are you doing in the window? And I wanted to stare at them because they were so beautiful.
I mean, as a Westerner, it's just, yeah, it's eye-popping. And you see, like, one street has got Asian women on it, another's got black women on it, another has blonde women. It's really like kind of a supermarket of flesh. So now, you've never had a taste of alcohol.
I've drunk champagne a couple of times, though.
Okay. Well, then forget what I was going to say. Have you drank champagne a few times?
I drunk Krug. It was really nice.
I'm a Veuve Clicquot man myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because that's what the girls on Absolutely Fabulous used to drink.
Yeah, that's right, Veuve Clicquot. Yeah. But I have not, I've never taken drugs, and I've never had a boyfriend.
Never had sex, never done drugs, and never really drank.
I never taken drugs, but I have taken ecstasy because it doesn't say anything in the Quran about ecstasy, so I did that.
Did you do ecstasy? Say it again. It's a joke?
It's a joke.
Okay. So you're just derailing the whole train of...
No, Tom, I'm just trying to fit in with you.
No, but that's what I was going to say. You've never drank, you've never done drugs, and you've never had sex. What's that like? Because clarity unto itself is a drug, you know?
It's stupid. It's really stupid. And it's inhuman. It's really inhuman way to live your life, but I've been brought up in this pattern and it's really difficult to break out of the pattern. You know, I probably will drink. I might take drugs. But you know, I don't know, I think I need to have a relationship with somebody or marry someone to have sex with them. I just can't go out and have a one night stand with someone. You know. It would be too much. You know, and I've waited this long. You know, to be honest, Tom, really, to be honest, I mean, it's been so long now. I mean, the only way I'm going to get it is if it snows heavily and someone slips in. That's the only way I'm going to get it.
Arguably the greatest rock and roll song ever written, talking about the devil. And I think what's important about this song is not the notes that Keith Richards plays. It's the restraint that the man has. The way he when you listen to that Keith Richards guitar solo at the end, just the way he holds back. I think most people would have overplayed that. But it's such an intense song, and I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Sinister. Thinking about how the devil permeated the world in all these different scenarios. And then the guy gets knifed at Altamont. Of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg. There it is. I stuck around St. Petersburg until I saw it was time for a change. Well, I should say that my first concert ever was the Rolling Stones at the Tangerine Bowl in Orlando, Florida. And, you know, God, I loved the Stones and thought the Beatles were a bunch of sissies when I was younger. And just, you know, I think, you know, England saved rock and roll, man. You know, The Who and so much badass music coming out of there forever, this tiny little island. I was puzzling you. Myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. in the song Rocks Off, which opens up Exile on Main Street, he says, "The sunshine bores the daylights out of me." And he says, "If I could only get my rocks off while I'm dreaming." Now, that is rock star excess, where you've had every orgasm possible, where if you could only be having orgasms while you slept, I think teenagers could relate to what he's yearning for, but I love that lyric in the song. There was another thing, and after we had met, and I mean, and you know, because we've been friends for a while, where it was kind of mixed envy, jealousy, with also pride. You were on 60 Minutes in the United States with Ed Bradley, and 60 Minutes is like the I grew up watching 60 Minutes. It comes on Sunday at 7 p.m. in the United States, and Ed Bradley specifically was this really this suave black guy, and all the other guys would do these really hard, you know, political things, or like, you know, putting CEOs of corporations on the spot. Ed Bradley was always like sipping wine in France and doing like hanging out with the Rolling Stones. Ed Bradley's niche was that he always did like artsy things. Yes. And so like I'm sitting there watching you going, oh my God, she met Ed Bradley. Was like my hero in life. He was like such a cool guy, and now he's dead. So what... What do you remember about that, and what do you remember about Ed Bradley?
Well, it was really bizarre because I'd obviously heard of 60 Minutes, and my manager rang me up and she went, 60 Minutes is the biggest thing in America, and they want you to be on there, and Ed Bradley is flying over. He's going to come and spend time in your parents' house with your mum and dad, and he's going to interview your parents, and he's going to interview you. I mean, I don't know, my parents' house, my parents are these Pakistani people who live in this house in Birmingham, who watch Indian films, my mother watches the Islamic channel. She does not watch CBS 60 Minutes. She watches the Islamic channel, you know, where like the people just praying all day on the TV. This is what my mum watches. And Ed Bradley, this lovely, suave guy, he comes over to the house and he's interviewing my parents, and he goes, "Well, you know, last week I was playing golf with Michael Douglas." And my mum goes, "Who is Michael Douglas?" It was just...
Your mother goes, "Name dropper."
"Michael, who is this Michael Douglas?" And my dad goes, "Yeah, who is Douglas?" And so they had no idea. My dad's going, "Oh, he's a Hollywood actor, Kirk Douglas's son. Have you heard of Kirk Douglas?" And my dad went, "Vaguely, vaguely." They had no idea. And then they had dinner with my parents. My parents cooked them chapatis. And it was really bizarre because I didn't really know who Ed Bradley was. I was new to comedy. It was a really new thing. I had no idea what I was getting into. And then he came to a gig that I was doing in Basingstoke in Reading, another provincial town. And he sat on the front row, and I was really new. And he watched me do comedy, and then he interviewed me. And I didn't realize just how big a star this guy was and how well-respected he was. And then I was in Canada at the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, and I was in my hotel room getting ready to go and do my gig, and there came an advert on the TV going, "Watch 60 Minutes tonight and see the world's first Muslim stand-up comedian." And I was just standing there unpacking my suitcase thinking, that's me. And I thought it was really, really odd, and I felt so far removed from it all. I thought, that's not me. That's not why I wanted to become a comedian. I didn't think that after a year of doing stand-up, I'd be profiled on 60 Minutes. I mean, it didn't mean anything to me because I had no story to tell. I hadn't struggled. I hadn't lived.
But you did have a huge story. But had you only been doing stand-up for a year at that point?
Yeah, it was about a year and a half. I mean, I had a story in that there was a huge struggle for me to be able to become a comedian and get to the stage. I mean, there was a huge struggle to be able to be a stand-up comedian. But I've got so many far more interesting stories to tell since I've become a comedian, and I've been doing it for 8.5 years now. And, you know, I've got a different story to tell now, which I think would be more interesting on 60 Minutes now. But
yeah, and where are they now?
Yeah, well, I hope. Just hope.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. So, how did your parents react to being filmed? I mean, I think anybody's family would feel uncomfortable. Like, you know, God, should we change the family photos and the, you know, the doilies on the tables? And
my parents saw it as an opportunity to get me a husband. They thought, well, if my daughter is on the biggest show in America, that means that everybody will see her and she might be able to get a husband. So they saw it as a marriage opportunity, as they see everything as a marriage opportunity.
So are you a failure because you have not been married?
That's right. I am such a huge fucking failure. This is
everything you've done.
It means nothing. I've been on 60 Minutes. I've toured all over the world. I've performed at the Palladium. I've done the Royal Albert Hall. I've been in the Vagina Monologues. I've done so much. It doesn't mean anything because I don't.
You weren't in the Vagina Monologue. You can't talk about your vagina. You're Muslim.
I don't have a vagina, but I made one up. I made it up for the show. But, you know, I mean, honestly, I can't. It doesn't mean anything because I don't have a husband, so therefore I have failed.
I remember thinking about you after the July 7th London tube bombings, and I remember thinking, oh shit, I bet Shazia is going to have a really hard time right now from like a backlash from English people. But, and then you make me think maybe it even goes beyond that. So what is the worst backlash you've had from non-Muslims doing what you do, and what is the biggest backlash you've had from Muslim people who don't like what you do?
I have to say, what are some of the biggest backlash I had was from other comedians. I had so much backlash from other comedians. Like you say, comedians were horrible to Margaret Cho, and she talks about it in her shows. They were like that to me as well. Like, I remember the night that Ed Bradley had come to see me, and 60 Minutes were filming this gig in Reading. And the MC, the compere for the night, he went to introduce me on stage. And I was waiting outside the room, and he told the audience, but he introduced me, and then he told the audience that I was being filmed for 60 Minutes, and he told the audience not to laugh at anything I did. And he gave me the most horrible, worst introduction, knowing that I was being filmed for the biggest program in America. He told the audience not to laugh. He told them I was rubbish. And then he introduced me, and he thought that I hadn't heard this.
And then Ed Bradley kicked his ass.
and then there was a bomb, and everything blew up. No, and then he introduced me, and it went well. The audience laughed. And then after I'd been on, he slagged me off again and said, you know, I didn't deserve to be filmed for 60 minutes. He couldn't understand why I was being filmed. And saying this to the audience, this is the night I'm being filmed for 60 minutes. And there was a lot of that kind of thing. From other comedians who were just nasty and jealous. And the thing is, I never asked to be in that position. I always wanted to be a comedian. I just wanted to go on stage, be funny, tell the truth about my life. And I didn't know all of that was going to happen to me. Why did I have to pay a price for that? And so many comedians were horrible to me. And I think that hindered my development, because I lost my confidence and I couldn't perform. And every time I went on stage, I kept looking to see if there were other comics in the audience and do they think I'm shit? And I became paranoid. And that was on top of the hate mail that I was getting from the Muslim community, who were calling me a prostitute for being a woman standing on stage telling jokes. They would go, you're a prostitute. You're going to burn in hell. You know, we shouldn't be making jokes about religion, and you shouldn't be on stage. You shouldn't be talking in public. I mean, I felt, but you know what, when you're at the bottom and you think, oh, I only came into this because I knew the truth. I came into it because I loved comedy and I wanted to be a comedian, so I carried on. But I think if it was anyone else, they probably wouldn't have lasted.
It's unbelievable, because I really think you're like a vanguard for Muslim people, like someone who really was, you know, someone who was representing a positive character, or a positive person, not a character, at a time that people needed to see positive Muslim roles in society. That's really interesting. The thing that I always tell people is that, you know, it is so hard to start being a stand-up comedian. And it's really difficult, and you got to, you know, go through so much bullshit. But I always tell people that it's even 1,000 more times hard for a woman, because it really is a man's industry, and it's so much, you know, backstabbing and pettiness, and a lot of women can't survive. So, you know, you being a Muslim woman comedian, I think you probably have had it. You had a harder start than absolutely anyone ever in the history of stand-up.
It's funny because, you know, we're the underdogs in society. Muslim women are the underdogs. You know, we never have a voice. We never get recognized for anything. You know, we're not really in positions of power. And then I came into comedy to do what I wanted to do. And the same thing happened to me. I became the underdog. You know, people didn't want to hear my voice. People were bitchy to me. I was still fighting. So really, my life in the circuit was a reflection of my life out of the circuit. And I thought that being a comedian would be liberating and I'd be able to say what I wanted. And I felt really repressed at times. I felt really repressed, and I felt really frustrated. And I thought, you know, because on one hand, I wanted to be myself and tell the truth about my life and just be funny. On the other hand, people expected me to talk about certain things. You know, I'd go on stage and people would, critics, reviewers would write, why is she talking about this when she could be talking about honor killings and arranged marriage and suicide bombers? Please explain to us. You're in a unique position. You know, you're an Asian female Muslim stand-up comedian. You should have a unique perspective, but instead you're wasting that perspective by talking about other things. So then I wasn't allowed to be who I am. I wasn't allowed to be myself. I had to be what other people wanted me to be, which was really frustrating because that wasn't liberating. That wasn't liberating at all.
Give it up, double large for Shazia Mirza.
Hello. Hi. So I've come from abroad. I've come from Birmingham. We have people from Birmingham. All the slags there. I don't know why people are ashamed to say they're from Birmingham, because it looks quite nice now that it's finished. I am from Birmingham. Obviously, I don't live there anymore because I'm doing well. But my parents still live there. They don't give a shit about anything I do. They just want me to get married. Obviously, Muslim men, they don't really want to marry me because I speak. But I am quite looking forward to my wedding day, you know. I can't wait to meet my husband. My friend Julie, she always says to me, how can you sleep with someone you don't know? I say, well, you do it all the time. I'm not saying all white women are slappers, don't get me wrong. But when I was growing up, my parents were quite strict, you know. I was never allowed to have boyfriends. I always felt like I was missing out, you know. I always wanted to be like my white friends who had abortions, herpes, and chlamydia. But my mum used to say, you have to wait until you're married, and then your husband will give you that. And then I went home the other week, and I walked in, and she went, just get pregnant. You know, there was no hello, how are you? How's the cancer? It was just get pregnant, which I think is really strange because my parents taught me nothing about life, nothing about men. I don't know anything about men. First time I kissed a man, I was 25. Second time I kissed a man, I was 30. By the time I'm 40, I might get fingered. And for the big 5-0, I'm going to donate my hymen to the Palestinians as a missile defence shield. They're just jokes. But I don't think you should ever listen to your parents, because all my life my parents would say to me, you know, don't go near men, don't look at them. If I catch you with a man, I'll kill you, kill him, kill his mother. Now, all of a sudden in the last 6 months, they say to me, so where are your children? Where are our grandchildren? And I think, how did they get from there to there? They didn't warm to the idea gradually. I've had to explain to my mother that in order for her to have grandchildren, I need cock. Now she says, so get cock. Get cock, get two cocks. Get five cocks, then you will have five times as much chance of giving us grandchildren. I said, but why don't you kill me if I have sex? She said, no, we will kill you if you don't have sex. I said, but you told me not to go near men. She said, yes. That's when we thought you had a chance. But now you're a shriveled old godless freak. You may as well fuck them all. Fuck them all. Eat pork, get pissed, fuck Salman Rushdie, just get fucked. Honestly, they're so desperate now, they will even take a ginger. The thing is, I just come back from America, I went there recently, not to blow anything up, just for comedy. And I was talking to this woman while I was there, she goes, oh, I love what you do, I understand everything you're talking about, because I used to live in Islam once. I said, oh yes, whereabouts? She said, Bradford. But there was a lot of prejudice while I was there, you know. Anybody with a moustache was a target. My mum was attacked. They kept saying to me, if you want to work in America, you must be more American. So I went to have Botox. And the surgeon said to me, that's $8,000, please. I couldn't even look shocked. I was walking down the street in New York, and this man shouted out, he went, oi, you packy, go back to India. It was Prince Harry. There's much discomfort these days, you know, amongst minority communities, because there's now white people coming from other countries gate-crashing our racism. The Poles, the Albanians, coming over here, stealing our racism. Once black people, they used to be at the top of the racist tree, yeah? I'm not saying that black people live in trees, okay? Now they must be thinking, bloody hell, those Poles coming over here, stealing our low-paid, shitty jobs that we didn't want in the first place. The thing is, I never suffered any racism in my life. When I was growing up in Birmingham, I saw graffiti once in big letters. It said, she's never been out before. It said, Packy, go home. It was my mum telling me it's time for dinner. But the thing is, I was invited to Buckingham Palace recently to meet the Queen, right? Now, I didn't know why the Queen had invited me. She sent me an invite in the post, and it never said why she was inviting me, and I thought, you know, maybe she likes my comedy, maybe she likes my writing. Imagine my disappointment when I turned up to Buckingham Palace to find 400 Indian people. And the realisation that the Queen had invited me to Buckingham Palace because she thinks I'm Indian. I'm not, I'm Pakistani. Mind you, it's all the same to Philip. And it was all going well, you know. There was 400 Indian people there. I met the Queen, I met Prince Philip, and we all had to wear a badge which said our name on and why we were there. Behind me, there was a man with the badge, and on his badge it said Afzal Patel. And I heard Prince Philip say to this man, there's a lot of your family in tonight. So I'm standing there thinking, this is material. So I stood there a bit longer. And then I heard this man trying to explain to Prince Philip that the name Patel, it means like Smith or Jones. And Prince Philip was looking at him like he couldn't give a shit. And then 2 days later, I wrote an article about it in The Guardian. I said, you know, I was there when this happened and I heard Prince Philip saying this to this guy. And then 3 days later, the Sun newspaper rang me up and they said, Shazzy, we've read your article in The Guardian. We heard you were there when Prince Philip said this to this bloke. We'd like to know, are you offended? I said, no, I thought it was hilarious. They rang me up 3 times that day to ask me, are you sure you're not offended? The Sun were offended on my behalf. You know, if Prince Philip had come up to me and said, Shazia, you little packy tramp, then punched me in the face with a gollywog wearing a Nazi uniform, yes, I would have been offended. But it was Prince Philip. I expected it. At least he's consistent. And now I actually get to meet her. And there's a perception that the Queen talks like this. It's true, she really does talk like this. I was standing in line to meet her and she went, and what do you do? And for some reason I got really nervous. And I started talking like that as well. She went, and what do you do? I went, I'm a comedian. I felt my Birmingham accent going up three social registers. You know, at one point, I actually said, yeah. The minute I realised this, I ended the sentence with, innit? And Prince Philip went, isn't it? I said, it is. And I didn't know what the fuck we were talking about. When I met Prince Philip, the first thing he said to me was, where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from Birmingham. And he said, no, where are you really from? And I said, oh, my parents are from Pakistan. And he went, oh, that's interesting. He said, I'm holding a lecture next week on migration. Maybe that would interest you. I thought, is he asking me to leave the country? So I said to him, you're 85, aren't you? And he said, yes. I said, well, I'm holding a lecture next week on dying. Maybe that would interest you. You've been great. I've been Shazia Mirza. Thank you.
One thing that I really like about you is your style. You have a lot of one-liners. And I've always loved well-written jokes and one-liners. Like Rodney Dangerfield was one of my heroes when I was a kid. And I think there's a real art to doing one-liners. So why did you get into the style of doing one-liners?
Well, actually, I've moved away from one-liners now because I like to tell longer stories. I like jokes, though. It's good to have jokes, just solid jokes about things. And a joke that people is going to hit you and you're going to remember. You know, I always have this one-liner joke, which I do, which really breaks the ice, is that I say, I've never drunk alcohol in my life, you know, because it's against my religion. But I have taken it up the arse a couple of times. And do you know what? Wherever I do that in the world, it always brings the house down. It's so inappropriate and it's such a one-liner. But you know what? People remember one-liners. It hits them right there.
Yeah, and my favorite kind of jokes are sucker punch jokes where you can't see the punchline coming. Yeah, yeah. And so that is a total sucker punch joke. It's because you think...
especially not from me. They're not expecting that. And you know, whether you think it's true or not, people laugh. I mean, they're forced into laughing with that joke. You know, I hit them over the head with that. And I love Woody Allen and all these one-liners. It's brilliant. And you can say so. You can say things about yourself. You know, tell one-liners about yourself. And it can be personal. And you can tell people about yourself just in one line. Then people remember you with that one line.
Did you do that joke in Lahore?
Yeah.
Wait, really? Standing ovation?
You know what? I was...
Women are crying. She understands us.
Before I did that, I gave a script to the promoters and they went through my script and they took that joke out and they said, look, you can't do that here. It's offensive. And I said, offensive to who? Who is going to be offended by that? I mean, I'm saying that I took it up the ass. I mean, I'm not accusing Benazir Bhutto of taking it up the ass, you know? And they took it out. Anyway, I went on stage and I did it and it brought the house down every night. Because that is what people do in Pakistan. They do that kind of stuff.
Take it up the ass.
Well, women do because they want to be virgins on their wedding night, so they take it up the ass instead. I don't know how that works, but so obviously they could relate to what I was saying. And it was everybody laughed every night. It was brilliant.
Many a truth in a joke, as my grandmother used to say.
That's what you can do with a one-liner. You can tell the truth in one joke.
Yeah. And cut down mountains.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember... your classic line. I mean, and that's the thing. Like you're saying, you can be remembered for a joke. And like just classic one-liners. The, my name is Shazia Mirza. At least that's what it says on my pilot's license. And I remember, I mean, I think I met you in 2002, right after September 11th or something. And that was, I mean, you could, I mean, like with the laughter, you could almost also, the audience would gasp, you know?
Yeah. And you know what? I have never heard the end of that joke. Everywhere I go, people go, oh, so you did that joke about the pilot's license, and they think I've just got one joke, and then I just go around the world doing this one joke still. But I did that joke, and people did, initially they went, like, oh my God. And I'm thinking, you know, I didn't do it. I didn't do 9/11. I don't know who did it. You know, it's a joke. I wasn't driving that plane. I wasn't a pilot, you know. And they went, and then they laugh.
Right, and but there's so many comedians, you know, a lot of really edgy comedians, and they talk about all these buzz things just to, you know, just to be shocking. I mean, and like rape or, you know, abortion or whatever, and just in the, but yeah, there's certainly, you know, it's strange that you would have a harder reaction from people from doing something like that. It's
you're right, you know, they have these comedians that just do rape jokes to shock or abortion jokes.
I think there's actually like a hackiness to like shock comedians. Like, you know what? Like talking about, you know, doing it to a nun and the booty is, I mean, it's like almost, or like doing things to children is almost like a hack. I personally find these things disgusting and not funny, but they're like, but they're among these shock comedians, there are like certain hack things. They like, oh yeah.
It's not shocking anymore. It's just not shocking. It's lost the shock factor. Once you've done it, it's lost the shock factor. And the thing is, there is a lack of emotional connection between the comic and that material, because you know they were not fucking a nun in the back of a boot.
Right.
You know, yeah, it's a funny image, but it's not true. It's not truthful enough for you to have a connection with that comic and think, yeah, yeah, you. Oh my God, that's so shocking because you actually did it. You don't believe them anymore. It's just shock for the sake of shock.
The plausibility in this joke is zero.
Yeah.
Now, what is, of all the jokes that you've written, what is the joke of yours that you are the most proud of?
Now I'm doing longer routines, right? I do stuff about my parents, a lot of it about my parents and them trying to marry me off. And
do you want to be married off?
To somebody who I want to marry, you know. But I said,
I think your life is going great. Why would you need a, you know? And I've always thought like about myself, like, I want to be married and I really want to have kids. But then at the same time, I think, do I really? My life is fantastic right now. And then, God, I might be really unhappy. And then also the other thing is, what if your children are jerks? You know?
What if your children are ugly? What if they turn out really ugly? How will you? I mean, but you have to have kids, Tom. You have to have kids.
No, I dream of it. Yeah, no, I want to have little comedians, you know?
Do you?
I'd love it, yeah. Totally, I would.
You say that now. If you got comedians, you would be pissed off. You wouldn't want them competing with you in that.
Daddy, does this joke sound funny? Come on, wouldn't that be great?
No. But it's great to have kids. I'd like to have kids. But I wrote some material about my parents, you know, when they were trying to marry me off when I was growing up. And I'd say, you know, but obviously Muslim men, they didn't really want to marry me. Because I speak, and I did loads of material about that, and that was quite truthful about going on dates with guys and stuff like that, and that was quite truthful, and I like that. I'm proud of that material.
Cool. Now, and the different thing in England is, like, I don't know if you've ever done Edinburgh, but for us American comedians, you know, you can develop your material, and here it's kind of different where. It's really strange. Like in London, everybody does 20-minute sets, and there are comedians that just have this same 20 minutes. They go A to Z, but then there is the daunting challenge of Edinburgh and coming up with an hour. I mean, so how would you approach, you know, shaping an hour show versus just writing jokes to be a comedian?
Well, I've done Edinburgh 5 times. 5-hour shows I've done in Edinburgh. And they've got better the more I've done them. You know, there's a craft in constructing an hour show as opposed to a 20-minute set. You know, you can tell one-liners for 20 minutes and make people laugh and get off. You know, and there doesn't have to be any of you in it. Whereas in an hour show, you know, you can tell long stories about your life, your background, what do you think? Like, you can do a whole routine about atheism and people will want to listen to it because it's in an hour show and you're in a theatre. If you're doing a 20-minute set, you know, in 20 minutes, people just want to laugh. They don't want to hear about your views on God and bloody changing the world. And I mean, you know, they don't want to know that in an hour you can do loads of stuff, you know, anything you like. It's an art, it's a craft in doing an hour. You know, and I really enjoy doing that. And I always write a new hour every year. I try to make it funny as well.
You actually write a new hour every year?
Yeah, I write an hour every year. But then there's always things in your life that you can write about. Or I find the best is when you're angry about something, when you're really pissed off and angry about something. You can write some brilliant rants about why you're angry and why the world is like it is, and you can write some really good routines. You get some good comedy from anger.
Yeah, it's funny. My brother always tells me that I'm funniest when I'm angry. And when I'm angry in my life, and I don't want to be angry in my life. I want to be happy, but my brother's always, yeah, that's the funniest.
I remember Richard Pryor when he was doing Live in Concert, and he said, I haven't done stand-up for a bit because I didn't feel angry about anything. But now I've been arrested for cocaine and my wife has left me. I'm angry and I've got this to talk about. It's good. It's good. You have to have that contrast. You have to have that conflict. There has to be conflict.
To be a great comedian, there needs to be conflict in your life.
Conflict, not maybe in your life, in the world. You know, when 9/11 happened, there was lots of conflict. There was lots to talk about. You know, when there's a war going on, comedians are angry. They've got lots to talk about. When someone's got divorced, you can do a whole show on your divorce and you're angry.
Yeah, but all that stuff's been done. That's why I think it's more interesting what you do than, I mean, like, the, just like the white male heterosexual opinion has been heard from, well, I'm not talking about me, but, you know, like, divorce and, oh, the new dad material and all that kind of stuff.
Some people do the new dad material great. Like Louis C.K. does the best new dad. To call your kids shits, little fuckers. I mean, who uses that angle? I mean, that's a brave and original angle, and that's what we strive for, is like a unique comic mind, a different perspective on stuff. Oh, most people that do dad material, it's quite boring, isn't it? We've heard it all. But if you've got a great perspective, if you've got a new perspective on something, it's always good to hear that.
I agree with you. And that was really dangerous what he did. And I remember, and that's the right kind of shocking. I remember watching that going, oh my God, is he really saying that?
But it was truthful. You could see that he really did think that his kids were shitting.
The other kid we have is, she's a girl and she's 4, and she's also a fucking asshole. It's true, man. I'm serious. I say that with no remorse. Fucking asshole. She's a douchebag. She is. Fucking jerk. The other day, I'm like, put your shoes on. We're trying to leave. Put your shoes on, please. Put your shoes on. Put your shoes on. How many times can you say that to somebody before you just want to kick them right in the fucking face? Seriously, if you're with a group of people that are trying to go somewhere and you can't go, because a member of your party just refuses to put their shoes on, that person is a fucking asshole, okay? You don't do that to people. Imagine being with a group, hey, we can't go. Why? Because fucking Bill won't put his shoes on. He just won't put them on. Fuck, Bill, what's your problem?
I don't want to put them on.
Fuck you! Fucking kids suck. Seriously. The other day, I walk in the kitchen. She's talking to my wife. She says, Mama, I saw a doggy today. And I was like, really? Where did you see a doggy? And she's like, I'm telling Mama, not you. I'm like, hey, fuck you. I'm just asking to be nice anyway. What, you think I actually give a shit about the dog you saw? Like that was going to be an awesome story that you saw a fucking dog. Who gives a shit? I got better stories than you. I have an interesting life. I'm on fucking television. I won an Emmy. You don't ask me what fucking happened to me today, you little bitch. No. I didn't say that to her, obviously. But that's the thing. Nobody ever calls her on her bullshit. That's how she got to be an asshole in the first place. Nobody just goes, ah, fuck you, you don't know. I'd love to, for one day, just fucking be totally on. Oh, you drew a dog? Let me see. That's not a... That's, shouldn't mean that's a scribble. That's nothing. That's not even anything. Show me a dog that looks like that. I'll give you $1,000. Seriously. God, fucking... Oh, the other day I was just like, just dreaming about just fucking kicking her. Like... kicking her out a window, you know, just fucking... I would never fucking hurt her, but I wanna. I do, you know? One time my daughter had a black eye because she walked into a door because she's stupid. And she had a little black eye. And I took her to ice cream. We went to an ice cream place. And everybody in the ice cream place is like, give me a dirty look. And I realized they think I hit her. And she has a black eye. Now that's why I'm taking her ice cream. That's what they think. And I was so insulted. I want to say, hey, fuck Alia, okay? She's this big. You think if I hit her, she'd have a black eye? She'd be fucking decimated. There'd be nothing there. Look at this shit. I would ruin her head with one punch, easily. She has no defensive skills. She fucking sucks. She'd be like just smiling at me. And like, there'd be just fucking... just a dent there like a fucking bomb went off. I don't know. I love my daughter, but people really don't get what it's like with a kid full time. Well, you know, we parents make you love our kids because we dress them up and take them out. Look at it, and everybody goes, "Oh, nice." But you don't know what she's like when she comes home. The dress comes off. She fucking rubs her ass in mud. She's fucking gross. She won't fucking take a bath. Like you can't. Once you have a baby, you can't force the kid. Fuck her. Let her sleep in her clothes. I'm not dealing with it tonight. Her hair gets clumpy. She stinks. Sometimes it's like fucking ugh, just fucking rancid, stinky fucking kid. She fucking in front of people. She like scratches her asshole in front of people. Like fucking deep asshole scratching in the fucking panties. And then she smells her finger. That's the kind of person I'm talking about. She's disgusting. The other day, I come home, and she's just laying on the carpet with just spread eagle naked, and she's just stretching her vagina open, going, ah, just fucking holding it open. I'm like, fuck, shit, okay. Wow. That's, wow.
We're at the Groucho Club in London, which, when I first came to London, I was brought here, and this used to be... Bruce Hills, the director of Just for Laughs, and this was always a film club or like actors and people, and it's members only. You have to be kind of a big shot to come here and be a member, and you're a member. And you,
Tom, or you have to be Jewish.
And neither one of us are, but you are a member.
Love the Jews. Love the Jews.
Say that again.
I love the Jews. Love them. Love the Jews.
You can't get ahead in show business unless you do.
I know. And that's why I'm saying I'm loving the Jews. I'm loving them. I don't want to piss them off. Fuck. I'll be fucked, wouldn't I?
So, we're at the Groucho Club, which is an exclusive private club for, like, actors and film people, and you're a member, and you said you wanted to meet me here, and so,
Said, no, it's okay, I've got a friend who's also a member, and I'm already...
Nah, that's not what happened. So, I just want to ask you, what happened to your humility?
What happened to yours?
We could have met at Starbucks.
I don't, you know what, Tom, I don't mind meeting at Starbucks, but I just can't have people hounding me for my autograph at Starbucks. Whereas here, it's quite, you know, it's private. I've been a member here for years. You know, my manager was a member, and she just got me in, but, you know.
Actually, and they are really nice to comedians, and it's totally bullshit. Yeah, they've, and that's the great thing about being a comedian. And the reason I've hung out here is because... loads of comedian friends of mine are members, and they really love comedians here, which is awesome. Yeah. Shows you.
Because it's called the Groucho Club, and it was named after Groucho Marx.
Yeah, and Groucho Marx had the famous line that I wouldn't want to belong to a club that would have me as a member. So what a brilliant name for a club.
Yeah, and also he had a great mustache, and so have I. So... I feel at home...
But now I guess you have become, because, you know, you're my friend, and I don't live in England, and this is my first time here in 5 years. I guess you've really become sort of a big shot, because you told me you're meeting the Queen tomorrow? You're meeting Queen Elizabeth tomorrow?
Meeting Queen Elizabeth tomorrow. This is true, and she sent me an invite in the post, inviting me to Buckingham Palace for tea tomorrow. She hasn't said why we're meeting, and I'm really worried. I hope I don't turn up and it's just me and her, because I will have fuck all to say to this woman. I will end up saying something like, "Oh, did you kill Diana?" that was something really inappropriate, you know, like that. But I didn't know what to wear, so I googled Diana actually, and I thought, you know, I will see what she used to wear. But then my mum went, "Don't go dressed as Diana. They'll never let you in." So I'm going to go dressed as a corgi instead.
Your parents must be shitting in their pants that you're meeting the Queen.
Oh, yeah. They're saying they are really, they're really, really... when I told my dad I'm going to visit the Queen, he went, "Is she going to make you into a dame?" I don't think I'm going to become Dame Shazia Mirza just quite yet. You know, Bruce Forsyth has only just got his OBE, you know, and he's been in the game 100 years. You know, it's not going to be me.
Step one, though, baby. Step one to damedom.
I do feel like I have a relationship with the Queen because this is the second time she's invited me to the palace.
Please, do tell.
I think I've, you know, she obviously likes what I do, and I feel like I'm having a relationship with her.
So the Queen has watched you on the telly, something like that, and she's invited you to the castle.
Because
we don't have a Queen. So, I mean, like...
Tom, it's not a castle. It's called Buckingham Palace.
Castle.
It's not a castle.
It's a castle.
You are so American. You just see a big house and go, oh, my God, it's a castle.
But are you working on your curtsy?
No, but I've been working, you know, I'll get really nervous and I'll start going, hi, how you doing? No, but I've worked on my hello, and basically...
What if nervousness, you like throw your personality out the window and just became a total loudmouth idiot?
What if I get really nervous and just go, assalamu alaikum? That's going to really fuck it up. No, but I've been practicing on my hello, and basically you say, how do you do? You say, how do you do? And you curtsy.
And she says, I'm the Queen. How the fuck do you think I'm doing?
I mean, all the scenarios that go through your head when you are meeting the Queen. Because, you know, this...
You'd say something like, I think you're the most attractive on the 10-pound note.
Because that's the weird thing. It's like, I've grown up with this woman all my life. This woman is...
She's on the money.
This woman is on the back of my money. I lick this woman's head on stamps every day. I have friends that...
Nuh-uh, they have adhesive stamps now.
No, but honestly, I've got friends who have snorted cocaine through this woman. And now I'm going to actually meet her. Oh my God, it's really weird. I mean, I've met Prince Philip before. He was a laugh. He was really good. The last time I met the Queen, she said to me, and what do you do? And I said, I got really nervous, and I started talking like her as well, and I went, I'm a comedian. It's really a nervous thing, you know, when you meet the Queen.
Yeah. But you're a true English subject. You're meeting the Queen. So she didn't know you the first time. But now, obviously, she knows. So, I mean, like, there's potential conversation that could happen.
Yeah, I mean...
Do you think you guys will talk about the death of that guy from Boyzone? You think maybe she'll be all upset about it?
What do you think of Gately? And I said, well, he was a faggot. I mean, what can you say? I mean, it's really bizarre what you think. You could not prepare for this.
I think she's actually pretty cool. I think you're gonna. I think. I hope you get to. I hope you get to have hours. I hope you become great friends with her. I think she needs to be your friend.
She needs to be my friend. I admire her.
She needs you more than you need her, Shazia. And you just remember that when you're getting a little nervous at Buckingham Palace tomorrow, you remember that what I said.
Yeah.
She needs you more than you need her.
I've got a couple of one-liners. I won't do my pilot's license, but I will. Think of a few funny things.
Do that. Do the anal joke. She'll love that one.
Sure. Yeah. That'll be the last time I'll be visiting the palace if I do that.
And then your head will be cut off in the square. And you'll go, why did my family ever leave Pakistan?
You know what? That will be the last time I ever drive through a tunnel. That is the last time I ever drive through a tunnel.
I hope you get to talk to her. And I actually think that she's probably a wonderful woman because when I first came to England, well, it wasn't the first time, but I think it was like 10, 12 years ago, I actually wrote the Queen a letter. I wrote her this big, long letter that I was visiting and that I really loved the country and that and only an American would do this. Totally. I'm totally American. And I wrote her that she should consider a knightship for Johnny Rotten, the lead singer of the Sex Pistols, and that her giving knighthood to Johnny Rotten would be equivalent of the Pope forgiving the guy that tried to assassinate him. Remember years ago, the guy tried to kill, shot him, John Paul II? And I actually got two letters back from her staff, and it said that the Queen had received the information. Someone must have told her. I don't think she read the letter. And that she was considering my request. And I got two letters back from her staff. So, I mean, it's not impossible to reach big figures of the world. And you're proving that.
I feel sorry for her. She was born into that, and she was born into royalty. She had no choice. And she's been shaking hands for like 80 years. I mean, it's really a bizarre thing to be born into and to do. And she still works. And I'm just so excited to be going to meet the Queen in my lifetime. She's very old now, and I'm going to meet her for the second time.
Wow. I'm really proud of you.
I know. I'm really excited. I'm really excited.
And you're from Birmingham, and you get to meet the Queen.
Can you believe it? I'm from Birmingham. Just an ordinary girl from Birmingham, and now I'm meeting the Queen. Whatever next?
All right, so we're going to wrap this up in a second. Yeah, yeah. But, do you know who Hershey Ali, Ayan Hershey Ali?
Yeah, yeah.
I did a gig with her in New York. You did a gig with her?
I did a gig with her in New York. She was doing a book reading. I was doing some stand-up comedy. She's Canadian. She's a lesbian. She wrote this book, The Trouble with Islam. She's had death threats, and she's a wonderful woman. She's a really lovely person. And I think a lot of Muslims have judged her and said, oh, you know, you're shit, your book is shit. And it's because of the way because she's gay and she lives her life the way she does. People have judged her because of that rather than on her work and her merits. And, you know, it's just another example of a woman speaking out and getting that backlash. And it's so boring now, Tom. So boring.
For women to get backlash?
Yeah, for women to get backlash.
But come on, don't you feel proud of your girl power? Because, I mean, you do represent, you know, you're a strong woman.
I represent myself at the end of the day.
And the thing that I was going to say was Hershey Ali, there was a quote from her that the Muslim world needed its own Voltaire. And I love her, and I read her biography. But I don't think that's true. I think the Muslim world and all of the world needs more comedians. I don't think they need boring French philosophers. I think they need more stand-up comedians.
Oh, God. Especially the bloody Muslims, isn't it? They need a bigger laugh than anything. That and the Argentinians. Oh, they are the worst.
Arrogant, head up their butts.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Anyway, well, I love you, Shazia. Thanks for being my friend, and thanks for chatting with me.
Sweet. Thank you so much.
Hey, and will you tell the Queen that your friend Tom said hello?
Oh, yeah. And by the way, Tom says hi.
The Filth and the Fury is one of my favorite films of all time. It's a documentary about the Sex Pistols, and I guess I first started going over to England in 1999. I think the film came out in 2000, and I actually wrote Queen Elizabeth, the Queen of England, a letter, and I just addressed it to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, Buckingham Palace, and I wrote her this letter, and it goes like this. Your Majesty, with the deepest respect and highest regard, I take pen in hand to reach out and express my truest words to you. Partly because you have always struck me as a sincere soul and the type of person and world figure that would welcome reasonable requests and ideas even from the most common of people. May I state foremost that I am a visitor to this kingdom of yours, and that I didn't think that there would be any harm in telling you what a dandy place I think it is. From the hearts of your people, to the life of its cities, and the breath of your luscious countryside. On my numerous journeys to Great Britain, it has consistently reassured my trust in the spirit of humanity, in the same manner that your portrait on all monetary notes give my being the calm, knowing presence that your portrait reflects. Particularly, your portrait on the 20-pound note is my favorite, and the one that I find the most flattering of you. This may also be due to the happiness I feel when I have a pocket full of your portraits, especially a 20 or two. If my viewpoint is slightly odd, it may be because I am an American, which will undoubtedly explain this letter's lack of sparklingly eloquent adjectives. I am also frequently employed as a comedian, although the intent of my request is serious aside from any undercurrents of humor that may accompany it. As absurd as my request may be, I ask that you, the kind, loving queen I believe you to be, to at least ponder it as I think it would be for the ultimate good of your people. My request from the truest bottom of my soul is the following. I ask that you would consider knighthood for John Lydon, a.k.a. Johnny Rotten, the former lead singer of the band The Sex Pistols. The most notable benefit of this act, I believe, is that it would be equal to the Pope forgiving the man who attempted to assassinate him. Moreover, I ask that the only convincing evidence you would need is to view the brilliantly constructed documentary entitled The Filth and the Fury, which came out earlier this year. In it, Mr. Rotten / Lydon speaks heartfelt words such as, "You don't write a song like God Save the Queen because you hate the English race. You write it because you love them and you are tired of seeing them get pushed around." Most importantly, highlighted in the film is the influence of British comedians on Mr. Rotten's performance persona and how he symbolically followed the sterling tradition of that supreme gift of humor that is bestowed upon the people of this great kingdom. It is this gift of humor that I believe is Britain's greatest gift to the world, and as such is something Mr. Rotten is the true personification of. Furthermore, it should also be understood that Sir Richard Branson, who defines the notion of knighthood in every way, was the producer of the Sex Pistols' ubiquitous first record, the profits from which enabled him to build his own empire. Dear gracious Queen, I do hope that you view the aforementioned documentary and come to the same conclusions that I did. My reaction after viewing The Filth and the Fury was that if I ever had George Harrison's kind of money, I would erect a statue to Johnny Rotten in my garden. But shortly thereafter, I realized that if I had George Harrison's kind of money, I could probably get Johnny Rotten to work in my garden. I would also like to thank you, if you have continued to read this far, for the grace and nobility you have displayed over the years in the face of the strife and turmoil that has involved your family. Above all, I believe that it gives people like me, who are from dysfunctional families, hope, and a beacon of light to follow, as your example has been. Indeed, you have shown that what may appear momentarily as a disaster is only the triumph that lays on the other side. Thank you truly for your time and care in these matters that I have stated so plainly. If there were a position higher than the Queen of England, I would surely write that person in charge and ask that you receive it. However, God has not a postbox that I know of. If you should feel the desire to reply to my letter or ever need my help in regaining the colonies, you can write to me, care of my mother, a woman undoubtedly that you would adore and have many knee-slapping laughs with. Her favorite thing in the world is taking time out for some tea, and it brings me unspeakable amounts of pleasure to bring her antique teacups and saucers from my visits to Great Britain. I hope that you may have found amusement and truth in these words of mine, and that the power of all the heavens continue to shine on you and the grand people under the glow of your reign. As for your kingdom, I must say that I like what you've done with the place. With my sincere acclaim and respect, Tom Rhodes. P.S. Did you know that Sid Vicious's father was a guard at Buckingham Palace at the same time that the Sex Pistols were causing so much trouble in your country? Yes, it's all in that magnificent documentary that I was telling you about. Thanks again, Tom Rhodes.
Sid's father was a grenadier guard. Imagine that. Sid's signing a very expensive contract while his old man's on guard inside the fence. It's genius.
According to the story, after this happy signing ceremony, everyone went back to the A&M offices to celebrate. The four Sex Pistols apparently over-celebrated and lived up to their public image of thorough obnoxiousness.
How you doing?
Get on. We got to A&M Records. Total bedlam broke out there as well. I can't really remember what happened. The secretaries were terrified and Sid was bleeding. All his foot was bleeding. I had a black eye.
Malcolm was running around, Steve was flirting with all the secretaries, and then we got in the car again and went to the studio and where we were recording God Save the Queen with Chris Thomas, and there's a school next door, and all the kids come running out because we were there, and they called the police as well. It's just a total mad day, you know. The next day we woke up, Malcolm said, well, A&M have fired you.
The anti-establishment Sex Pistols called in the establishment press to protest what had happened to them.
You feel that we're like some contagious disease. I mean, when you walk in and out of a company and the guy just gives you, look, you know, take this money and don't come back. What are you supposed to think about that?
Have you had the money?
Yes, they gave us the check last night.
Makes it very clear where their heads are at.
Nowhere.
We weren't the nice boys they thought we were. We aren't nice boys. We were fucking nasty little bastards. And we still are.
Virgin Records signed them, and Johnny Rotten got to record his Queen's Jubilee memorial song, God Save the Queen.
You don't write God Save the Queen because you hate the English race. You write a song like that because you love them, and you're fed up with them being mistreated. Was the alternative national anthem. What we offered to England was a pivotal point. We were the maypole that they danced around.
And then I actually got two replies back to my mom's address. As you see on Buckingham Palace stationery, this letter is dated September 13th, 2000. On Buckingham Palace stationery, it says, "The Queen has asked the private secretary to thank Mr. Tom Rhodes for his letter and to say that it has been passed to the private secretary, 10 Downing Street, so that this approach to Her Majesty may be known and consideration given to the points raised in the letter." Let me point that out again. The letter starts out, "The Queen has asked the private secretary to thank Mr. Tom Rhodes." So she may have read it, or someone read it to her, but the Queen heard my letter or read it. And who knows, maybe she got a chuckle. So I got a reply on Buckingham Palace stationery, September 13th, 2000. And then I got another letter, and this is dated September 20th, 2000. And it is on, the stationery is it's from the Cabinet Office Ceremonial Branch, Nominations Unit. And it says, it's funny, it says Tom Rhodes Esquire. It's addressed to Tom Rhodes Esquire. "Dear Mr. Rhodes, your letter to the Queen concerning the honors nomination for Mr. John Lydon, a.k.a. Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols, has been forwarded to this office as the Prime Minister is responsible for advising on the award of civil honors. I shall ensure that your nomination receives careful consideration. Yours sincerely, Abby Oshodi, Case Officer." I'm sure they passed that letter around and everybody got a chuckle out of it. And that was basically all I was trying to do was, you know, I'm sure the Queen gets a lot of boring-ass letters and, you know, hey, can you come to this, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken opening in Essex or whatever. Who knows what kind of letter she gets. But I thought, you know, hey, I'll give the Queen a chuckle. And I wrote her a letter. Dave Fulton is an old friend of mine, and I met him in San Francisco years ago when I lived there. He's actually from Idaho. He's from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And then he got, I think he went to Seattle, and that's where he started developing as a comedian. And he was always a funny guy because when comedy was exploding, like MTV had a show and all these different networks, I remember seeing him. We did a lot of auditions together when they would come to clubs looking for comedians. And he would invariably always shoot himself in the foot by going on stage and talking about how much MTV sucked or whatever the network was. And I would, you know, give him advice that, you know, nobody's going to put you on the air if your whole act is saying how much that network sucks. So he went over to England as well. And I think he did the Edinburgh Festival one year, and he met a very attractive, wonderful British woman. And they got married, and he lives in London. And I'm pretty proud of the guy. He's over there. He's slugging it out. And he's, you know, he's in heavy rotation in all the British clubs. Hey, I'm in Kingston-upon-Thames with Dave Fulton, one of my oldest friends in stand-up comedy. And Dave, you originally are from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, but you for many years were in Seattle, and then now for many years you've lived in London. You've been one of the few American comedians to bust the scene. You and I have known each other forever, and, you know, how long has it been? What was it that brought you to England or brought you to Europe, and what made you go for it as an American comedian, and how difficult did you find it when you came over?
Wow. I've been asked this question a lot, so I have a pretty set answer, but I'll go into it more because I love you, man. What happened? I came here by accident. I was kind of, you know, doing the American thing and pissing people off, but in the wrong way. And a friend of mine at the time, a guy named Brian Catalina, asked me to come down and be a unit production manager, you know, whatever, for a documentary that was going to be shot in Paraguay in 1996. And I went, all right, cool. And up to that point, I'd been to Mexico and Canada. That was it. And so suddenly, I'm in South America. I went to Peru and went to Paraguay. And in 96, they got their liberation from a dictator named Stroessner in 89. So it was a pretty new country. I mean, you couldn't even buy a postcard. And after hanging down there for 4.5 weeks and, you know, meeting all these people from different economic priorities, I just kind of went, wow, I have got to get the hell out of the United States more often. And I remember coming back and doing a college gig thereafter and drinking yerba mate on stage and getting people turned on to that. And, you know, and they hated the show, but I had a great time. And I just thought, I got to get out of here. So I talked to a mutual friend of ours, Greg Proops, who's done very, very well for himself in the past in the UK. And I mentioned, I said, yeah, I'd like to come out and check out Edinburgh. And he said, he was talking about, hey, I hosted this thing called the Big Top, and next year when I do it in 97, I'm only bringing my friends on stage. And I said, well, if I show up, will you put me on? He's like, yeah, totally. So I gave it a thought, and I came back. I said, yeah, I think I'm going to come out to England, and I want to go up to Edinburgh for a couple of days, maybe do your Big Top show. And he said, well, first thing you got to do is get yourself a place to stay in Edinburgh because they fill up fast. So I got that done. And then I was going to come out to England and do some sets. And he said, here's some numbers, you know. So he gave me a whole page of numbers of people to call. He said, first people to call is the Comedy Store. So I, you know, started calling all these people, and some of them weren't even, you know, around anymore. I said, all right, cool. So I lined up a set with the Comedy Store and talked to some other people about it. And then Mitch Hedberg, who was kind of opening for me occasionally in Alaska, and I'd run into him, you know, on the road before he became huge and a junkie. He says, oh, I did that. You should call this guy John Keyes. So he gave me this guy named John Keyes' number. So I called Keyes up, and I sent him some tape. One thing led to another. He got the passport. He got the work visas and shit. And I came out, and I did Edinburgh. I went up to Edinburgh for 6 days and did two sets and got really drunk and had a really great time and thought it was the most amazing experience. And I came down to England and down to London and did a great spot at the Comedy Store, and I went, you know, and they gave me a gig right away for February in 98. And then I went out to the Junglers and Bow and pissed everybody off and died on my ass. And went home a week early. I actually was here when Princess Diane, you know, went into the wall. and saw all the flowers building up, and I said, oh, that's all right. So, you know, and I was still living in Seattle, and things were kind of, you know, clipping along, and I came out here for 6-7 weeks in 98 and played Amsterdam for the first time the week after Louis C.K. I had a great time, fell in love with the city, and then one thing led to another, and it was one of those things where, as a comic, if all you really want to do is you want to get on stage and tell jokes, you're willing to go anywhere they're willing to pay you to do that. And at the time, you know, England was going, come back out. And I was like, all right. So I just kept coming back out. And I'd come out for, you know, nothing longer than 7 weeks, nothing shorter than four, and justified the ticket and all. And I was actually flying myself out there, you know, out here to England for, you know, $800. And I was able to make enough money to cover the flight, cover my expenses, cover my rent and my bills back in the United States, and still come back with a few $1,000 in my pocket. And I thought, this is kind of good. And then one thing led to another, and it just kept working for me. And it wasn't like I wasn't getting work in the States. It's just like, you know, out here, it's like I'll work here every goddamn weekend. I'm like, okay, I'll come out every weekend. And one thing led to another, and before I knew it, you know, I was just working here all the time. You know, I did my first Edinburgh in 99. And I met my wife-to-be, and the rest is kind of history. And if somebody said, what have you changed in your act to make it more compatible for the British that you didn't for the English? I have no idea. I just do what I do. I kind of, you know, adapt something that endears me enough to the audience that allows me to get away with what I want to get across. And I think coming out here has probably made me a stronger comedian. I mean, after being working here for, you know, 3 or 4 years, I remember going back to the States and running into friends I hadn't seen in a while, and the first thing they said is, damn, man, you have raised your game. And I never had my sights set on this. I never thought one day I'm going to come out to the land of irony and carve myself in my own little niche. It was all kind of a big happy accident, and I've just kind of let that go. I mean, I've allowed myself to just kind of be led down that stream. I mean, it's too often you think this is what I really want, and you're battling the headwater, and you work your ass off, and you finally gain that thing that you really thought you wanted, and then you got it, and you're like, God damn, I worked really hard to get this, you know? And then sometimes you just go, well, I'll just see where this takes me, as long as you're staying proactive in what you're doing and trying to remain fresh. And then next thing you know it, you go, whoa, look at this, you know? I've done shows in 23 different countries now. You know, that's amazing. You know, it's kind of wild, and I enjoy the adventure. So,
but you know, you do have to have some sort of game plan to break into England. And friends of mine ask me, you know, how did you get in with Europe? You know, and it's like anything. I invested a few trips over to London, stayed on a friend's couch. I mean, you had to do similar kind of thing. So, what are some of the first mistakes that you made when you came over? And what are some of the things you could warn other American comedians about mistakes not to do if you're thinking about cracking the British market?
Well, the first thing you should do if you're going to, you know, mistakes I made is not realizing how amazingly expensive London is. I totally underestimated how expensive this town is. So whatever, you know, if you come out for your first time and you've lined up all your gigs via the internet, which I didn't have, at the time, I didn't have the internet. I had a lot of phone calls. But if you line your stuff up on the internet and you have the advantage of YouTube and people can see on YouTube and go, all right, I'll book in your stuff. Some clubs like the Comedy Store still won't accept any kind of tape, any kind of links, any kind of YouTube. You have to come out and actually physically do a set. So just suck it up and do it. Just be prepared for that. Be able to, you know, find some place that you can stay cheap. There's a lot of hostels in the area. Sometimes, you know, because you need work papers now, work visas. Whoever's going to bring you out, they'll have connections, maybe find you a place to stay where you're going to have to shell out, you know, probably $100 a week. I mean, you know, maybe $200 a week, you know, which for London is, you know, can be cheap. And just invest the time, you know, look at it as an adventure, you know, and see where it takes you. And just prepared to keep coming out and coming out and coming out. And that's what I did. I kept coming out because I thought it was kind of cool. I mean, like, wow, I'm doing shows in Woking, you know? Now I won't. But at the time, it was kind of cool, you know? And I was meeting people and I was having a great time. And it wasn't, it was funny because we talked about the fact that, He's like, oh, man, are you getting a lot of action with women? I really wasn't. I wasn't getting that lucky. And I think it has something has to do with the fact that on stage I wasn't nearly as endearing as Tom Rhodes was.
I love playing in England because British people love Americans just recently. It's been the best last couple of months for me. Because I've been playing in England for like 3 years now, man. And fuck, it's been hard as an American. Shit. As a comedian, I'll get heckled for crazy shit here. People would yell out shit like, fuck you in the Panama Canal Treaty of 1874. Are you still hanging on to that? Going to Great Britain. I fucking love that. Because, you know, there was a committee that decided that, you know? Why did they stop at Great? Why don't we be Magnificent Britain? Hey, 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 hey. Don't get ahead of yourself. What about Splendid Britain? That's too showy. The women in Scandinavia are beautiful. You know why? The Vikings didn't bring back any ugly ones. And if you want the full impact of what I'm saying, visit Scotland. They didn't build those castles fast enough in Scotland, man. Somebody from Scotland always comes up to me after the show. I didn't like that joke, and they got all fucked up teeth and spina bifida. Thanks for changing that.
But, like, what about the times you fell on your face? And what about advice that you could give an American comedian that would come here to help him not fall on his face?
Well, the biggest advice I can give anybody is people here will heckle you. The difference between heckling in America and heckling in the UK is in America, they will heckle you because they have an issue with what you're talking about. In England, in the UK, they will heckle you just to see what you're made of. And if you can come back on that with a certain amount of wit and intelligence, they'll respect that and back off, you know, most of the time. Sometimes they'll keep coming at you, but that just means they're drunk. But, yeah, and I have, and my favorite story is I was playing the Comedy Store the very first time, and I was opening the second half of the late show on a Saturday night, and they were insanely drunk. 400 people in the room, all to see the last guy act, a guy named Lee Hurst, because he was huge back then, January 98. And I got on stage, man, and I was having good shows. I mean, this was the fifth show of the weekend, and they were not buying it, man. They were like, you know, and it was the first time I ever heard, I did a line and somebody yelled out bollocks. And I thought, wow, does that mean right on? You know, and I never forget, man. I remember looking at my watch and seeing 13 minutes and I had to do 20. And I told this joke and it pretty much kind of went blah, 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 this and that. And that's why it's funny and that's why you people are fucking stupid for not understanding that. And I pretty much told the British crowds, you're an idiot for not getting humor. And they turned on me. They started yelling at me, get off. You've had the pies. You've eaten the custard. All these, you know. And I remember looking at the sound guy to my stage left, a guy named Jono, who I liked, and you know, he liked me after meeting him for a couple nights, looking for something on his face that said, whoa, look at this, or hey, get off, or you know, run. And he was blank. He was just staring at me. And I thought, whoa, you know. And so I'm kind of, you know, it was like en masse. It wasn't like a couple people. So I was like, oh, whoa. And I said, you know, look, the insults don't work if I don't understand them. And they came at me, they're like, you suck. I go, yeah, but you paid to see me. And then finally one of the, I said, I'm going to do one more joke and get out of here. And they're like, fuck that. So I looked at my watch and I'd been on 17 minutes at this point. You know, I've been kind of battling for 4 minutes. So I put the mic in the stand. I said, well, I'm going to get out of here, which they claimed a victory. They're like, yay. And I said, look, before I go, I just want to say, if you're going to be drinking tonight, I hope you drink a lot. And they're like, yay. And if you're driving home later and you're drunk, I hope you die in a fiery, drunken car wreck. And if you ever do go to America and you go to Disney World, I hope your children are killed there. Good night. And they looked at me kind of like, ooh, that was a bit rough, you know? And part of the crowd laughed and applauded, and part of them just didn't do anything. They were just shocked. And Mike Gunn actually was in the audience and saw me. He told me that many, many years later. And I walked off stage, and Mickey Hutton, who was comparing, just kind of goes, "Ah, don't let it go." And he went up and did a joke, and Lee Hurst went up and rocked the room. And I remember being in the back room going, "Wow, it's really weird. I've never had white people boo me like that." And Don, owner of the store, Don Ward, walks in. And Mickey Hutton, I'm thinking, "Oh, crap, just look, you know, don't get his eye, don't get his eye." And Mickey Hutton just yells, "Hey, Don, can you get some flowers for Dave here? Because he fucking died." And I laughed it off, and Don laughed it off. And I was scheduled to do the club 2 weeks later. And I thought, Monday morning, we're going to get a call. Don't bother, this and that. No call, no nothing. And I was told later the reason that Don had me back was, A, he loves it when it mixes up like that. He likes it in international bill. And the fact that I went down swinging, you know, because I've seen so many acts go up, get hit like that, and just anything from tears to fuck you and leave. As opposed to, well, all right, and, you know, and insult them and then leave, but in a kind of a clever manner. And that saved my ass, and he's had me back ever since. So
now that is what? We're talking 98?
98.
Now, but the most remarkable thing about you that I think you deserve a medal for is that you were an American playing in England and all over Europe and the world during the George Bush years. You know, I lived in Holland. But the Dutch are really kind of sweet people. I mean, you know, how bad are the Dutch going to fuck with you? English people will jump in your shit, like you're saying. If you're an American comedian, you definitely have to be on your toes. But you weathered the storm, Jackson. You were tied to the mast and going through the fucking hurricane at the absolute worst time to be an American in human history in Europe. And you're on stage being a stand-up comedian with a microphone. So the degree of difficulty to be a comedian is already, you know, it's difficult, period. There's certainly a trick and seasoning and education and knowledge to pull it off. But what can you tell me and anyone listening about, you know, what it was like in those years for you to be an American during the Bush years?
Well, when Bush got elected, I didn't like him first off because, you know, when he was governor of Texas, I thought he was shit. And then he got elected, and, you know, my dad's a Republican, and he's always voted Republican. And then he said, Bush said one thing at the beginning of his presidency that I was like, rock on. He said, "We are no longer going to be the police force of the world. It's about time people start taking care of their own shit. We're going to start pulling people out of bases. We're going to start downsizing. We're going to start taking care of the American people." And I went, all right, way to go. And then 9/11 happened, and then we lost everything.
And then we're the police again.
Yeah, and now we're the cops again, you know. And now, you know, the Republican government had their thumbs in more shit than any Democratic government ever had. Which is, you know, people will be debating forever, but there's hard physical, you know, facts with that. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think conspiracy theories will always find fertile ground in the weak-minded. And so I don't really have time for that. But having Bush as president, it was always really weird because, you know, you do a show with a bunch of Brits, and they'd go up and they'd slam America. Slam the fucking country. Fuck, Americans are stupid, they're fat, this, and, you know. I've had MCs go on stage and go, "America's this," and people are like, "Ah, and Bush is a fucking idiot. Ah, all right, you guys ready for your last act? Ah, please welcome from America, Dave Fulton." And I walk out to slings and arrows. And, you know, you had to hit the fucking crowd, the ground running. And, you know, and luckily, you know, I'm not a bedwetting liberal, but I just hated that prick. And I was able to come up with facts and figures and say, yeah, you know, he's an idiot. And which was tough working with British comics who were always pointing their fingers. And I'm like, yeah, he can point, but I'm fucking living in the middle of the cesspool on a regular basis. And my taxes in America are funding that prick. Now, when you're in Europe and you're kind of, you know, bashing this and bringing up the facts that people know or think they know, and then you go back to America and you go, oh, by the way, our president's a piece of shit. And especially in April 2003, when we were sacking Baghdad, you know, going into Iraq under the illegal invasion, violation of UN Charter 1441, which I will fucking keep repeating till the day I'm dead. I'm in Austin, Texas, at Hicks's Club, Capital City Comedy Club, big fucking poster, Bill Hicks, Stanhope's in there, all these other guys. So I go on stage and I'm fucking bashing Bush, bashing the war, and people are not digging it. They are fucking looking at me like I'm the Antichrist, for Christ's sake. Until one night, this guy yells out, "Hey, quit making fun of our governor." And I said, "You're so fucking stupid. You don't even know he's been elected president." And nobody laughed. Nobody. And then a month later, I called up Rich Miller to try to get back into some other clubs. And he said, "We've had a conference call about you, and the owners of the Capital City Comedy Club feel that your politics are keeping the crowds away, so we can't bring you back." And I'm like, "Fucking Bill Hicks, isn't it?" "Yeah, but that was another time." And I'm like, "Yeah, but Doug Stanhope was talking about this shit." And he goes, "Yeah, but he'll shave his balls on stage so people show up for that." Yeah, they haven't?
Yeah, they haven't.
They're, you know,
they got his picture up.
They still got his picture up, and people still point at him.
And they wouldn't work Bill Hicks today either.
No, they would never work Bill Hicks today. That's the irony of it. So that's the thing, is you and I hate to use the words enlightened. I think it's broadening your horizons of living in Europe. You see that America is not so much, you know, the only power. We have to learn, you know, this is so fucking obvious and mundane, but we have to learn to live amongst each other, you know, on this planet. And a lot of Americans don't, and they don't want to because they want to hold on to the ideal that was never there in the first place. So, but Bush, you know, and then, you know, and then of course, you know, toward the end of his presidency, a lot of people that supported him suddenly started to wake up, and all the people I remember watching doing, you know, really crass, borderline racist, you know, jokes regarding Muslims are now bashing Bush, you know, and I'm just, you know, and I'm doing, well, where were we when I needed you 4 years ago, kind of thing. So, yeah, it is. And after Obama got elected, a lot of people said, "Well, I guess that's the end of a lot of people's act." And you're like, no, this is not the only joke I have, you know. But it was a motherfucker, man. It was a motherfucker.
I'm not the atypical American, should probably let you know. I live here in London, and so obviously I'm not incredibly obese. I know how to get around. I don't shout shit out in public for no apparent reason. I can pronounce the word Lester. Though I still like saying aluminum, just to wind you fuckers up. You're easy. I like being with people. I'm not really used to the whole drunken kind of chest out, you know, physicalness you guys get in on the weekend. You go to Hammered, want to beat the shit out of each other. I generally try to keep my head down, shut up, you know. Now and then, though, a couple years ago, walking through Trafalgar Square, a little drunk, talking too loud with a friend of mine. This guy hears me. He's like 20 feet away, breaks a bottle. He goes, "Hey, Yank, what can you do about that, huh? Huh?" And I'm like, "I don't know, walk over there." I've been robbed 4 times at gunpoint. You think broken glass is going to throw me for an afternoon? At gunpoint. See, I like guns, being an American. I think they're kind of cool. I just don't think they should be used to get cheap oil. Last time I was robbed, I had the guy actually put the gun to my temple so hard it bruised my temple. And he's screaming at me. He's like, you know, "What do you do now, huh? What do you do now?" And I'm like, "I don't know, river dance? What do you need? Here we go, here we go." He's like, "Give me your wallet." I'm like, "All right, here you go. Fucking take it." He's like, "All right, what else you got?" I'm like, "Nothing." He goes, "Give me something else." I'm like, "All right, how about happy ending? There you go. How about that? There you go." I'm back on the West Coast. I was just there recently, and they're like, "Man, you know, you still living in London, Dave?" I'm like, "Yeah, getting it done. Yeah." He's like, "You know, with the terrorists and stuff, is it harsh?" I go, "No, dude, we get on with the day. It's no big deal." And he's like, "Well, why don't you worry? You mean you still riding the bus and the tube over there?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah, living the dream. Yeah, right there." But now when I ride these particular forms of transportation, what I do is I bring my own copy of the Quran with me. You know, because I have all the holy books. I own them all, man. I have the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, the Argos catalog. Keep it in my bag, though. Don't want to show off. And I'm on the bus, right? If a guy gets on the bus, just in case, and pulls out a copy of the Quran, starts reading it out loud, making the other passengers nervous, I just pull my copy out, make eye contact. "Hey, what's up?" Give it about 4 stops. If he hasn't calmed down, walk over to him. "Dude, what are you doing? Didn't you get the memo?" "Yeah, this is my bus. Get the fuck off." here's your rucksack, man. Thanks, I got one, really. Main reason I'm over here a lot, though, came over a while back, is I lost all confidence back in the current administration back in the United States, mainly George W. Yep, I will take a big shit on your gray bush. Came up on the horizon, and, you know, and you guys, we dragged you into that. And somebody said, well, geez, how come Tony Blair keep, you know, following Bush around all the time? I said, what, are you kidding? You just want to get out of the house. Have you seen the look of his wife? Holy Christ. No wonder you want to be in office for 10 years, you know? Just get him out. I mean, how does he do it? He's talking in public, gesturing with his hand. Sherry Blair walked in the room, turned around. Hey, Sherry, I thought I told you to wait in the car and bark at strangers. All right? I mean, you guys wouldn't fault, you know, Tony if he went astray. You know, he's due. I mean, everybody else under him has done it, for Christ's sakes. John Prescott got laid. How the hell did that happen? You kind of had a little pity for the woman, didn't you? You think, how did she survive? Probably kept him on his back with a biscuit. Doesn't matter, man. We drug you in Iraq. Yeah, you didn't come kicking and screaming. You did it. Yeah, down there looking for the weapons. There isn't any, judging from the price of petrol. No fucking oil in Iraq either. Every time I go back to the States, gotta listen to American friends of mine whine on about the fact they gotta pay $3 a gallon for gasoline. It's $3 a gallon, Dave. It's horrible. Really. I got friends of mine in England would kick a nun to death for $3 a gallon.
So, you've lived in England for how many years? And do you think, is there any way these people could be less miserable?
English people love to complain. They love to moan about shit. If they don't have something to moan about, if it's too hot, I'm too hot. If it's too cold, it should be warmer. I mean, just on and on and on and on. And it's like a friend of mine says, English people are the only people I know that hate their country so much that when they go on holiday, they'll dress for the environment that they're going to when they leave the house. They'll show up at the airport wearing flip-flop shorts and a tank top in March, you know, because they're going to Spain, you know, because they want to get the hell out of here so much. You think a country that owned the whole world and then they lost it, why did they end up here? Why did they just move the whole thing elsewhere? I don't know, man. And you're right, it is. This is, if you want to work internationally, you have to get in with London. With the rare exception of maybe Australia, I mean, because they'll book out of the States. But for the most part, they'll take what happens in the UK more seriously than what happens in America. I mean, if you want to do the festivals in Melbourne and Adelaide and New Zealand and whatnot, you've got to do the Edinburgh Festival. You know, that's the only, they come, they buy out of that all the time. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I pissed off the people that run that thing, and I could have got in before, but, and I've been there. I mean, Australia's great, I'll go back. I'll work Sydney and have a great time. But, yeah, but you got to come here. You want to work internationally, you got to go internationally.
Now, my favorite Dave Fulton story just happened a few weeks ago. I'm staying with you at your really cool house in Kingston-upon-Thames, and you take me to this your local pub where all these guys, what's it called?
The Willoughby Arms.
The Willoughby Arms. And we go to the Willoughby Arms, and the bartender owner guy is great, and he's lovable and just funny and piss taker. But there were a couple of guys there, old, drunk, bitter English guys, who they wanted a row. They wanted to fight. They wanted a verbal fucking dust-up about America versus England. And they were saying all kinds of, like, ignorant, stupid shit. And it was just the quintessential moment of being put on the spot for being an American in Europe. And you were my hero, dude. You just, you were like the ultimate cage fighter who could not be beaten. You were crushing heads. Some guy, I forget what it was. What were they saying that night? But the guy they're telling, you know, we got here too late in World War II and all this shit. And then you started laying down some shit about Montgomery. Oh, God. British general, for being a fairy and having a closeted gay lover and all this shit, and you silenced these guys. Can you recreate that evening for me at all?
Well, it wasn't like I was getting down on Montgomery for being gay, but it was more of, you know, he was calling us hypocrites, and you came to the party late, which is in reference to World War II, and my comeback is always, yeah, well, fuck you, the Japanese invited us. We didn't want any part of it. We've had past conflicts, you know, in World War I where we lost a shitload of guys. This is between you and the Nazis, you know, and Lord Chamberlain, you know, he fucked it up anyway because he got a piece of paper from Hitler that said he wasn't going to bother him, and he believed it. Everybody in America knew that was bullshit, you know. So anyway, this guy was laying down some stuff about us being, we didn't really need you to finish the war off, and I fucking went apeshit on him because, you know, Montgomery had a huge ego. Patton hated him. Some people may even debate that the war would never have been won if it was for the egos of Patton and Montgomery. And, you know, and if I was involved in a conflict like World War II and I was killing people constantly, maybe occasionally I'd need a hug, you know. But this guy was laying into his heart. I love the fact that he said, America's the most racist country in the world. I'm like, then why do we have a black president? You know, and I came at him with regards to the British National Party, which is, you know, a huge kind of fascist revitalization of the British white man. And they've elected somebody to the Minister of European Parliament, a guy named Nick Griffin. And I tell people, I get on stage and I said, look, you know, you people are going down about, you know, oh, yeah, I can't, they protest the BNP and Nick Griffin and this and that. And I said, and Americans are amazed because Americans, we have our racist parties. We, you know, Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, Aryan Brotherhood, white, you know, all this other kind of crap. And they run for office. And I tell them the difference between us as you is we don't fucking vote for them. You did. You voted this prick in. And the fact that you didn't vote for him and you didn't vote for anybody, you could have voted for somebody who wasn't the BNP. You didn't even do that to try to keep him out of the office, you know. So don't come off me on that. And it was great. It was great fun because these guys came at us from all fronts. And it was one of those things where we had from one guy just kind of matter-of-factly, but maybe this, maybe that, to that real hardcore guy that was a Daily Mail Sun reader, you know. And, we didn't get out of there till 3 a.m.
No, but you were my hero that night. You were laying down such solid, explicit, intelligent arguments of why they were wrong. And the one guy was such an idiot. He was going on about, well, America's the only country where you could go to jail for life for stealing a pizza or like a loaf of bread. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, the three strikes you're out, law. Yeah. And I'm like, no, because my brother was a lifelong criminal, and he was facing the three strikes you're out law. And no, it has to be three violent crimes. And, you know, my brother was facing 25 years, but it wasn't a violent crime. Mm-hmm. And so I knew for a fact what the guy was saying was horseshit. And I told him, and it was just like we were under a constant barrage for being American, and we're just there having a fucking beer.
But if you notice why we're fending our honor as Americans, you know, for whatever that may be, and keeping these pricks at bay, every time our beers are empty, they're like, you want another one? They would buy us another round. Did you notice that? I mean, we were arguing with them, going, no, you're wrong. No, you're racist. No, you're racist. You're a prick. You came late. Oh, fuck you. Fuck you. You need another beer? Yeah. All right. Hey, go get another round here, you know? So it was one of those things. We'd buy a round. They'd buy a round. We'd buy a round. So, you know, they enjoyed the interaction. And they enjoyed, you know, the verbal conflict. Maybe that one guy not as much as the other guys. But yeah. But you run into that over here. You know, you run into a lot of guys who are, you know, they're willing to hang out at a pub. And, you know, it's the nice thing about the British pub is you can walk in on your own. And if it's a good pub, by the time you get your second beer, you can strike up a conversation with somebody, you know. And everybody in that pub, I mean, when I first went there, my wife, Angela, would not even go near the place. Oh, damn, man. Knocking off my hippo. And they wouldn't even go near the place. And but I did because they were just, you know, they're proper working class folks, man. I mean, they were and willing to engage, you know. I mean, even though they're all blue collar, a lot of them, because they live in Europe and you're kind of, you know, immersed in this shit, they're able to hold a conversation here, you know. Goddamn. I remember when I had my place in Silver Lake, I had a chair outside, and you fucking love hanging outside You, as a matter of fact, when you got your series, you got a place on the hill because you look
that
being
was a cool pad you had in Silver Lake, man, and your little back patio looked. It was like such a great little valley and hills of lights. It was so so the perfect Hollywood.
I could have bought that place for $200,000 in 1995. You know, and you had the money, and I didn't know you. But the but no, the in when you got your series after, because you got your series in 96, 97, yeah. But yeah, you said I would just get a couch and hang out on this fucker all the time, all the time. But man, I remember, because the thing is, it's kind of like saying, you know, what's the one moment in your life that, you know, defined? I don't know, man. There was just so many moments we've shared together. I mean, I have, you know, from you know, scoring stuff to getting hammered to, You know, spending time in Amsterdam together, where you cracked open five bottles of the fucking amazing champagne and shared it with my wife and Steve and Julie. You didn't have to do that. I think it's just your general generous spirit kind of, you know, allows you to kind of gloss over the times when you go, "What the fuck are you doing with your life right now?" You know, damn, there's so many times. I think that time when you and I were coming back from that NACA conference is always one that hangs with me, where we're coming back, it's late at night, you know, and you were shell-shocked, because I'd done a bunch of them, and it was your first one, and you were like, what the fuck was that? Because it had nothing to do with comedy.
Yeah.
It was nothing with comedy, and it really kind of, as comedians, you start thinking about, wow, there's a whole financial aspect to this art form that we haven't really taken into account. And and the fact that you've never really had a real job. You always started as a comic, didn't
never
you?
Never done anything else.
Yeah, yeah. Where I've had to fucking get up early in the morning, go to work, and realize how much, and realize this is the easiest job I've ever had. You know, this is the best job in the world to have. You know, fuck, do you think me being a lawyer or teaching music in some school somewhere while I'm trying to hit up on some 17-year-old fucking flute player would lead me to be able to travel around the world and make people laugh to feed my ego, you know? I mean, you understand the fact that comedy is a narcotic, and if you stay off that stage too long, you start going into withdrawals. And, you know, with all the shit happening in your life right now, one could argue that, yeah, maybe being on stage is the best place for you to be right now, to take care of yourself, because that's going to allow you to filter through, give you the time alone in front of a room full of people who want to hear the ha-ha, and, you know, and get that down. So, no, man, that, you know, every moment with you is a moment to regurgitate to somebody else. So I just look forward to the next one.
Well, regurgitate to me the night we had all that champagne in Amsterdam. I was king of the world. My best friend Dave comes, and Steve-O, who I also love, and you guys had your wives, and I was king of the world. And, yeah, money and living in Amsterdam. And let's have more champagne.
Damn, you were across the street from one of my favorite whiskey bars, the L&B, right? It has every whiskey ever made, ever. And we'd gone out and had a couple drinks and something to eat. And then you went, you know, hey, you know, I did this travel show. Because it was one of those things where we had a couple beers.
I had just come back from the Champagne region. Yeah. I had just done a highlight on the Champagne region of France. And I brought back like 8 bottles of champagne with me.
You were like, you suddenly turned into the champagne sommelier. And you...
And I had studied the history of champagne, so I knew everything. So I'm like totally like just waxing on to you about the history of champagne as I'm opening it. And I'm sure you guys were like, yeah, just fucking pour it.
No, because I was interested because I love the history shit, you know. And Steve, of course, is like, oh, that's, you know, we can make a show out of this. And Julie, because she works in product placement, was thinking, oh, okay, well, maybe I can call these guys and get these champagne on the next show I'm working on. And my wife, who is English, went, shut the fuck up, we'll open that champagne. And you open every bottle. I met this guy, and this is from the monks, and they did this and did that, you know. And I tell you, man, I fucking hate champagne. I'm not a big champagne fan because it fucks me up. But because you grabbed 8 of the best bottles of champagne outside of some gangster wannabe rapper Cristal bullshit, and, you know, from rosé champagne to, you know, all this kind of crap. And it was all from the Champagne region, because it can't be called champagne unless it's, which I learned from you, can't be called champagne unless it comes from the Champagne region. It was a happy accident made by some monks or some shit. And you started whipping the shit out, and you opened every fucking one of those bottles. It wasn't even a matter of like, let's try this one, and I will squirrel the rest of the way to impress some, you know, naive Dutch chick.
Well, that was it. I had thought, all right, I'm going to bring back all the champagne, and man, there's going to be so many dates that I'm going to bring back here, and I'm going to milk this for all it's worth. Probably three different, four girls that I'm just going to hypnotize on with romance and champagne. And then here I got, like, you know, some of my oldest friends, and I was like, fuck it, I'm going to drink it all with you guys. You know, forget women.
Yeah, you were single. We both had, you know, Steve and I had our wives there. You had no women. And so what do? I'll just impress everybody. And you open all them fucking bottles of champagne. And it was one of those things. I remember getting them next morning, open the fridge looking for milk for coffee. And there was no more bottles of champagne. And the weird thing was, and this is how you knew your shit, and that was good champagne, is I didn't have a hangover the next day. I mean, that's how you know you drank good booze. I remember the first time up in Edinburgh drinking McEwen's ADP, which is a typical Edinburgh Scottish beer by the pint, and never got a hangover. You know, I mean, never got vomity, kind of pukey sick. And same thing with the champagne. I thought, oh, I'm going to pay for this. I'm going to have the splitter of a headache. And I was fine, man. That was fine. Goddamn, Jesus, you know. And what was great is part of me is kind of thinking, hey, man, why don't you hold some of this back, you know? And of course, you were popping.
It's a better memory that we drained it, you know.
Once again, coming back to, it doesn't matter. You got to have a good story.
I wouldn't be interviewing some Dutch chick I went on a date with right now. You know?
No, that's for sure.
Happiness list number 341, the Champagne region of France. I had the travel show in Holland where I got to go around the world, and I actually did a highlight on the Champagne region of France. And I read all about the history of champagne, and it's quite remarkable. My favorite champagne is Veuve Clicquot, and I was turned on to Veuve Clicquot by Absolutely Fabulous. That's what the girls in Absolutely Fabulous were always drinking, so that's where I got turned on to Veuve Clicquot. But Veuve Clicquot actually was a very interesting person. This woman and her husband opened a champagne vineyard, and the husband died when they were 27, and the woman went on to continue the business. And in French, veuve means widow. So Veuve Clicquot is the widow Clicquot. And she did a really remarkable thing. When champagne was in its earliest development, they couldn't get the sediment out of the bottle. And there's all these caves in the Champagne region where all these bottles are, they're in these caves, and they have crap and soot all over it that they wash off and sterilize before they slap a label on it and sell it to you. But it's this really long, drawn-out process, and the sediment was always a problem. It always had crap in the bottom of the bottle. And Veuve Clicquot, it was her idea to store the champagne bottles upside down or at an angle on these wooden holders, and for somebody to come by and turn it a quarter every, I don't know how often. And that solved the sediment problem. And then there's also the story of Dom Perignon, which is really, one of the most expensive ones you can get. But anyone in the Champagne region will tell you it's not that much better. And I prefer Veuve Clicquot myself. The story, Dom Perignon is good. Dom Perignon was a monk with the church, and he's in the company he's given in Chateau Mondon, however you pronounce it, Moët and Chandon, that's it. They give him credit for discovering champagne, that he actually drank this magic liquid, and his famous quote that's in all their literature is, "I am drinking the stars." That's what he said when he discovered it. But it turns out, the book I read about the history, that was actually hogwash, that the guy, actually the bubbles troubled him, and he spent most of his life trying to remove the bubbles. So that's just a marketing thing. thing. So I had done the highlight on the Champagne region for my Dutch travel show, and then I went back with this Muslim girl that I was dating with at the time, who I was so in love with and wanted to romance her completely. And we made this epic trip, and I bought a case of champagne. I think I actually got, like, you know, half Moët and Chandon and half Veuve Clicquot and then a few other ones. And I, in my refrigerator in Amsterdam, I had stocked with the finest French champagnes for, well, a couple weeks until it was all gone. Champagne is this magical liquid, and I remember, you know, being in high school, if you bought some for a girl, it would have magic seduction qualities. There's just something about champagne, and if you know anything about champagne and get anything above the cheap stuff, you're a hero.